Sick Boy Podcast is a health and comedy show about what it's like to be sick. Wait, is that right? How can illness be funny?
You'd be surprised.
Okay. Sick Boy is hosted by
me, Brian Stever.
And me, Taylor McGilvery.
And myself, Jeremy Saunders.
Come on in and join us to melt your heart, learn something fascinating, and bust a belly laugh. Trust us, you'll be glad you did.
You can find Sick Boy on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your pods.
This is a CBC podcast.
You know, most of the time when artists come into the studio, I have to talk to them about the thing that they're here to talk about, like a tour or an album. The great thing about Katie Lang getting the Governor General's Award, like the highest honor a Canadian artist can achieve, the great thing about it is that we can talk about everything. And we do. We talk about her incredible career, how groundbreaking she was, and whether she's ever going to make new music again. Katie Lang is coming up. Plus, what would you do if you could live yesterday over again knowing what you know now? That's kind of the premise behind Patrick J. Adams' new show, Plan B. But he'll tell you it's about way more than that, including, like, what happens when we realize there are no do-overs in life. Patrick J. Adams is coming up. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. Katie Lang is one of the biggest music stars ever from Canada. She's from Consort, Alberta. She started out making country music. And she'll tell you, in those early days of country music, she didn't really look like a country star. She had short hair and glasses and suits. But she sounded incredible. Take a listen.
How can't you feel my love growing? Can't you see it ain't a showing? Oh, you must be knowing I got a big, big love.
I think if you only half know Katie Lang, you know there's something subversive about her. And it was hard back in those days. Like in 1992, she came out as gay publicly, which brought all this hostility towards her. She talked about being a vegetarian, which made a lot of folks in Alberta hostile towards her. And she sort of left country music and made a big pop crossover record. And that made country people hostile towards her. But man, it paid off. Take a listen.
And
so now Katie Lang is about to receive the highest honor in Canadian art. She's getting the Governor General's Award for Lifetime Artistic Achievement. What I love about Katie is that she'll tell you, she can't tell you why her life turned out the way that it did, but she can share some memories. And that's what we did. Here's my conversation with Katie Lang.
How are you?
I'm good, my friend. How are you?
I'm good. Nice to talk to you as always. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What do you make of it?
It's wonderful. I mean, first of all, it's just an incredible honor. There's so many incredible Canadian artists, and the list of people who have received the honor in the past is it's very surreal, and makes me feel old.
Why is it surreal?
Just because I think it's very, very hard to have actual perspective on your own life. It's like asking an apple how it tastes. An apple has no idea how it tastes.
It's hard to step outside of it because you're in it.
Yeah. I have no idea about my life or my career. I have memories, but in terms of perspective, I have none.
You know, that makes the two of us.
Yeah, good. I'm in good company.
You want to talk to someone else who doesn't know anything about your career? I'm only kidding. Well, let's get some memories then. Do you have a first memory of knowing that you had a voice that might be a bit special?
I remember, I had a guitar when I was really, really young, and we had this mirror, this full-length mirror at the end of the hallway in our house, and I was playing the guitar in front of the mirror, and I just kind of knew. I just instinctively, innately knew that this was it, that this is what my path was. And I think it was more about being famous than it was being a singer.
You stood there with the guitar and you weren't thinking like, oh, there's something coming out of me singing wise. It was like, I want to be a big famous music star.
It wasn't even I want to be. It was like, oh, this is what I am.
Well, let's jog some of those memories then. I got a song here from your Patsy Cline tribute band. They were called the Reclines. And this is a song called Friday Dance Promenade.
Dippity do my hair to style. Study the mirror for a while. Take you home.
home to wine and dine. Put on the hi-fi, some Patsy Cline. I'm in love, L-O-V-E, love. Swing your partner, swing them high, element left and leave side.
Yeah, okay, so I was kind of aimlessly looking for something to do when I was living in Edmonton. I knew I wanted to be in music, but I wasn't sure how I wanted to present myself and so forth. And there was an ad in the newspaper for a deal at this recording studio in Edmonton. For $500, you press 1,000 singles and you got to record it and mix it. I asked my mom, she gave me the $500. I went in and then I met Larry Wanagas, who became my manager, who owned the studio. I showed up in this homemade sweatshirt that I had. I had written what I thought was Patsy on, like painted Patsy on the sweatshirt, but I was stoned when I did it and it was pasty.
Oh, good.
That stuff sort of happens, you know.
Why was Patsy Cline important to you?
Something happened when I listened to Patsy Cline that unlocked all these portals in my mind about how I could approach country music.
I go out walking after midnight, out in the moonlight, just like we used to do. I'm always walking after midnight, searching for you.
Humor and the costumes and performance art and sincerity, and I don't know, there was something about Patsy that just took my soul and my brain and went this way. She just was the impetus for all of it, really.
I want to skip ahead a little bit to 1985. And you win the Juno Award for Most Promising Female Vocalist. And it's funny, you were just mentioning like how country music helped unlock a very funny part of yourself, like a mischievous part of yourself. And I think that really comes across in that year, because at the Junos, you wear this big, fluffy wedding dress and you're whipping around the stage and you're doing a jig. What do you remember about that?
The recent history of myself at that time, I was very immersed in performance art and hanging around artists. So, you know, it was performance art based, but it did have sincerity in it.
I promise that I'll work harder next year than I have in the past 2 years. But most of all, I promise that I continue to sing for only the right reasons. Thank you very much. I love you.
I was very happy to win that Juno. It meant a lot to me. I remember saying that I promised to sing for all the right reasons, which was, you know, authenticity and truth and try not to sell out and try to retain a deep connection to pure inspiration, which is very difficult sometimes.
It's difficult to keep that connection to pure inspiration because money gets involved and other people get involved and people who are trying to stop you from trusting your instincts and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, marketing and what works, you know, formulaic intent and expectations.
It makes sense, right? Because then the music you keep on making is sort of beloved because of its sort of undeniable quality, like an undeniable purity and an undeniable like musicality. I want to play another one of those songs right now. So this is, you won the first Grammy in 89, and it was for the duet you did with Roy Orbison. Take a listen.
I love you even more than I did before, but darling, what can I do?
Cry,
So that duet earned you a Grammy for country collaboration in 1989. You also won for female country vocal performance. My guess is you don't listen to your own music very often. What did you feel when you heard that just then?
Oh, I was remembering Roy, and I was, that boy was full of emotion. Like, he was just all of, when he sang, it just, you couldn't stop the hairs on your arm from standing. He was just so ethereal and mysterious, very, very quiet, but warm and open, very elusive, but an incredible experience. I've told this many times. When we were recording it, that in Vancouver, we leaned in when we were rehearsing, or maybe we were taking an actual track, I don't know, but we leaned in to share a microphone and our cheeks touched, and it was so electric, and his skin was so soft and his voice was so powerful. It was just all these like contrasting emotions. It was incredible.
That's beautiful. That time, Katie, when Crying Comes Out and when you win that Grammy, it gets really, really big. Do you remember a moment where the kind of fame started to sink in, the moment you realized that your music was reaching people all around the world?
When you were asking me that question, this moment popped in my mind when we were making Black and White Nights with Roy Orbison, and I was a part of the backup singers with Bonnie Raitt and Jennifer Warnes, J.D. Souther, Jackson Browne. I'm forgetting one person, but anyway, we were on stage, and I look out into the audience, and there's all these people, and I had the high part in Only Dreams. No.
In Dreams.
In Dreams, and I had the high part, and so at the end, it's really, really high soprano part, and I look out, and Billie Eilish wasn't even born yet.
She wasn't a speck in her mother's eye at that point.
Billie Idol was looking at me, and I just kind of like gave him his own snarl back and was like, yeah, okay, there it is.
I can't help it, I can't help it, if I cry.
And there's Bruce Springsteen and Elvis Costello on stage and Tom Waits, oh my God, playing keyboard.
Wow. I had the DVD of that when I was growing up, and I watched it over and over again. You didn't look out of place to me. Like, you looked like you belonged there every time I watched it.
Oh, I definitely belonged there. I was in it. I was fully, fully present for that. That was just an incredible experience.
You did something, and the first time I met you, we talked about this. You did something that surprised a lot of your fans in 92. You come out with Ingenue. You had sort of had a lot of success and a lot of expectations on you, is my understanding, as a country singer. And the songs on Ingenue were a bit poppier. They were a bit harder to define. I'll just play one of them. That's so beautiful. That's Katie Lang and Miss Chatelaine. I think a lot of people were expecting more country music from you. What do you remember about the decision to veer away from that on Ingenue?
For my whole country career, I knew it was just a temporary residence in country music, because I never listened to country music as a kid. I was aware of it, mostly through KTEL ads, when those used to come on the TV. But I kind of shunned country music as a kid. It wasn't cool. And I was listening to Cream and Maria Muldaur and, you know, Delaney and Bonnie Bramlett. And country music was just a piece of performance art for me, ultimately, although the music I sang with utmost respect and homage, and because there's so much truth in the music emotionally. But, you know, I think when I look back at my music, even ingenue, it's all performance art.
How do you mean?
I mean that it's not one record could ever completely encapsulate who I am or who I want to be or what my musical taste is. Like, it's very, very small increments of or refractions of what I am.
I understand that. I also understand that ingenue, it came with sort of this backlash from the country music establishment, I think from people who were kind of like, I thought she was one of ours.
Yes, I remember that part. It was kind of this weird user-friendly relationship with country music. I don't think they wanted to fully embrace me, and I certainly didn't want to be fully embraced by them. I was creating a buzz for new, younger audience for country music, but at the same time, I don't think they really wanted to embrace my lesbianism or my vegetarianism or, you know, my short hair, my crazy cowboy boots. And they were sort of disappointed, but I think they were kind of relieved when I moved on.
Right. It was around then that you, we talked about this before, it was around then that you came out publicly in The Advocate, right? It was around the same time?
Yeah, I came out in 1991, just before Ingenue came out, in press for Ingenue. Well, officially. I mean, I don't think I was ever in the closet. I don't think that I ever pretended to be anyone who I was, except who I was.
Yeah. What do you remember from the public part of that?
Well, it was on the heels of the PETA thing, you know, the Meat Stinks campaign I did with PETA, which was extremely volatile and hard on everybody, hard on my mom, hard on my friends and people in Canada here.
Right. I should say, for people who don't know, the Meat Stinks thing you're talking about were these like ads you had done with PETA promoting vegetarianism.
Meat stinks, and not just for the animals, but for human health and the environment. Please write me on a free brochure on how to become a vegetarian. There's millions of us. And I'll even send you one of my favorite recipes.
You got a lot of heat for that at home.
Yeah, you know, bomb threats at the record company and so forth. It was... That was the hard part. So coming out was a piece of cake, actually.
I've heard you reflect back on this time of your life, and you said something like, when I look back to that time around Ingenue, you know, when the record blew up and Miss Chatelaine blew up, and then, you know, I came out and there was a lot of, like, attention on that because I'd come out very publicly, that you felt like that was the time you became public property. What do you mean by that?
I think more so with my sexuality, I think, because at that time, the AIDS crisis was in full blast. I mean, it was, you know, a lot of people were dying. And so I came up because I thought it was an important, responsible thing to do, to open myself up to having people have a connection to what gay culture is. So I came out so people would have some relatability to it. And I also didn't want to be outed by Queer Nation. I just thought it would be more graceful if I just stood up and took my accountability.
How comfortable were you with, these are very personal things, like what you eat and who you love are very personal things. How comfortable were you with attention on that kind of thing?
I think it was mixed because, unfortunately, it afforded me more media. I mean, fortunately and unfortunately, it afforded me more attention, which is why we're in the business to begin with, quite honestly. I mean, it was a catch-22, you know. It was, it sort of commandeered my career from then on. I really think my sexuality ended up overshadowing my music for a long time, if it still doesn't.
You feel like your sexuality, like being gay,
was the dominant story over your music.
Mm-hmm. I kind of do, but hopefully over time people focus back on my music. I feel like that sort of started to happen.
Yeah. I'll tell you one of my favorite records you ever made was, can we just play a little bit of it? Take a listen to this one. Katie, do you want to tell me what we're listening to right now?
Yeah, I like that one too. Honey and Smoke from the Case Lang Veers album, which was a collaboration I did with Nico Case and Laura Veers.
I love that song.
Oh, thanks. I do too. Thank you.
I really do love that song. It's funny to talk about Nico Case and Laura Veers. You collaborated with them. You told me a great Roy Orbison story earlier. I know you work with Tony Bennett and like all these incredible people. I wonder if I could get a memory from you about like one special collaboration you've done that still kind of blows your mind.
Okay. I'm only doing this reactionary because it doesn't mean it's the top one, but the one that popped in my mind when you asked me that question was this big concert I did in Wembley Stadium with all these people. And I sang with Chaka Khan and we sang a Sting song, Every Breath You Take. And man, singing beside Chaka Khan.
Wow.
Oh my God, she was so incredible. She is such a great singer.
What do you mean? Like, what do you remember feeling? I want to hear more about that. Like, it's amazing.
Oh, just her freedom and the tone and the ease. I don't know. I think maybe it was my first, real proxy to a great R&B singer. But man, she just blew me away. That moment blew me away.
Shout out to Q producer Vanessa Greco for tracking down the actual performance. That's what you're listening to right now. Katie Lang and Chaka Khan doing Every Breath You Take, recorded live at Wembley Stadium in 1997. You're going to hear more of my conversation with Katie Lang coming up.
Hi, I'm Jessie Cruikshank.
Jessie Cruikshank.
I host the number one comedy podcast called Phone a Friend.
Girl, let's phone a friend.
Not only do I break down the biggest stories in pop culture with guests like Dan Levy and members of NSYNC, I do it with my own personal boy band singing jingles throughout. Because it's my show.
It's your show, girl.
New episodes of Phone a Friend.
Yeah.
Drop Thursdays wherever you get your podcasts.
So work it, girl. Yeah, work it.
Okay, that's enough.
If you rely on a muse in the first place, you have to trust when they're not there. I mean, I think that's where faith lies, right?
I'm feeling mighty lonesome.
When I asked Katie Lang if she'd be making any more music and she said that, I was bummed about it, but you can't argue with the logic. I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q. It makes sense, right? Katie Lang has been following muses her entire career, and we've been talking about that on the show today, from being in a Patsy Cline tribute band to making big country songs to making pop crossover records, political statements that took incredible courage. And we talked about this earlier, but I kept coming back to this moment at the 1985 Juno Awards, which are like the Canadian Grammys. And Katie Lang shows up in a big wedding dress, gets on stage, and makes a vow. Here's more of my conversation with Katie Lang. 1 o'clock I'm thinking back to what you said at the beginning of our conversation. We were chatting about the Junos and the wedding dress, and you said, yeah, I said, what do you remember about that? And you said, you vowed only to sing for the right reasons. And you talked to me about, you know, that reason was for purity, sort of an uncommercial, like doing things for the right reasons in service of art and service of the song. Has that changed at all over the years?
No, it hasn't. It's gotten worse, actually. The perimeters and the checklist has gotten shorter and harder.
A higher bar to hit.
A higher bar. Thank you. Yeah. I don't know. It's just there's you know, when you're on the showbiz train, there are a lot of opportunities and there are a lot of salesmen and there are a lot of people wanting to jump on. And it just has to ring true. Like it really, like if somebody asks me to do something, it has to hit me on every level, like on my spiritual level, on my instinctual level, on my creative level and the humor level. Like it has to just ring with me. And if it doesn't, I have to pass. And lots of times I've passed and it's not been the best for my career.
Oh yeah, really?
Yeah. Don't ask me for an example.
I won't. I mean, I want to, but I won't.
Okay. I know you. I could hear it.
So are we going to hear from you again? Are you going to, I got to ask that. Are you going to make more music? I'd like you to.
I don't know. There's nothing. The vault is empty. You know, there are things that come up. Like, for example, there may be a new Case Langvier song, not an album or anything, but a new song. There may be a collaboration here and there, but in terms of me touring, in terms of me making another record, it's an empty vault. I don't know what to say. The muse is definitely not flying around in my space right now.
Are you comfortable with that the muse isn't flying around?
Yes, I am, because I think if you rely on a muse in the first place, you have to trust when they're not there. I mean, I think that's where faith lies, right? When it's empty and when it's not the way you want it to be necessarily, that's faith.
Oh, what a line. If you're going to rely on a muse at all, then you got to also rely on it when it's not there too.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you got to remember that the other part of music is silence.
Wow. Yeah. The part that's not the voice, the part that's not the singing, the part that's not the instruments, the part that's not the sonic presence. There needs to be a silence in order for us to appreciate that thing.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm sad about it though, because you know I love you and you know how much I love your singing.
Well, if you've been doing your rehearsing, we do have a duet in the pipeline, so.
Me and you?
Yeah.
We were going to do One Toke Over the Line at one point. Do you remember that?
Exactly. I know. I'm waiting. In Lawrence Welk style, weren't we?
We were going to. Yes, I'm so happy you remember that. We were going to do One Toke Over the Line by, who is that by? One Toke Over the Line, sitting downtown at a railway station. One Toke Over the muse is with me right now, Katie.
Was it Mungo Jerry?
Brewer and Shipley, by the way.
One Toke. Sweet Jesus, one toke over the line. Sitting downtown in a railway station, one toke over the line.
Oh, really? Somebody looked it up.
Vanessa here in the studio looked it up because she's amazing.
Yeah. Well, I'm most excited about our outfits.
Can I be Brewer and you be Shipley?
Or do
you
sure.
What do you have in mind for our outfits? What are you thinking?
Well, if we're doing it in Lawrence Welk style, it's going to have to be a velveteen tux and a long gown. And you can wear the long gown if you want. I don't care.
I am beyond in to this. Don't back out when I come knocking on the door saying we're going to do it.
I won't. I promise you.
I'm glad. Hey, before I let you go, anyone, any artists you love these days? Any new artists that are like exciting you?
So many. Oh my God, so many.
Give me one. Give me a couple.
Okay, one. This is just because, again, it's the first one that popped in my head. There is a band called Say She She, and they have a song called Fortune Teller, and it is so stuck in my craw that I want to die. On honestly, like at 4 a.m, this thing is like incessantly circulating in my brain.
All right, I'll take a listen. What are they called again?
Say, she.
Yeah, and the song is what?
Fortune Teller.
All right, I'm going to look it up. I'm glad you're still listening to new music. I'm glad I get a chance to talk to you.
I'm glad to talk to you too, sir.
I love talking to you.
Me too.
Yeah, and I congratulations on the big award. Well deserved, and I hope you can sometimes access the deep love that I feel like so many people in this country are like aiming towards you.
You know, it's funny because I was watching basketball the other night, like I do when I'm a Portland Trailblazer fan, and Damian Lillard is my man, and he just scored 71 points the other night. And, you know, there's something different about him, and I think it's because he really plays for the people, and I would like to think that is also for the right reasons, that I don't own it, that I sang for everybody. I sang because it's what I do. And so the love coming my way is definitely in reciprocity.
Katie Lang, congratulations. Thanks for the time.
Thank you.
The coffee's all gone and my eyes burn like fire. It's way past the hour when most folks retire. You told me
that is the legendary Canadian singer Katie Lang and Last Cigarette. She is soon going to receive one of the highest honors in Canadian arts, the Governor General's Award for Lifetime Artistic Achievement. If you ask me on the right day, I will say things like Katie Lang is the greatest singer in Canadian history. It depends on the day. Today is one of those days. It'll be official at a gala happening in Ottawa on May 27th. If you could turn back time, what would you do? Would you relive your childhood? Would you warn the world about the pandemic? Would you write a hit song for Cher called If I Could Turn Back Time? But if you could turn back time, like, would you act selfishly or would you try to help people? And that's one of the questions that the new CBC show Plan B asks. And Patrick J. Adams is the star of the show. He plays a sort of like toxic lawyer who is not great to his partner and finds himself with the ability to turn back time and fix his mistakes. Patrick J. Adams is a really thoughtful guest. He's a really thoughtful talker about whether or not we can learn from our mistakes and what it means that we can't turn back time, that the present is all we have, and how beautiful life really is. That's something I think about a lot. Patrick was the star of a show called Suits. He starred in that alongside Meghan Markle, you might remember. So we talk a little bit about that. And we start out by talking about something we noticed, that Patrick J. Adams tends to play a lot of lawyers. Take a listen to this.
It's funny to look at how your career has kind of turned out with the various kind of things you've done, including like a lot of law gigs. So I just read this the other day, that the UCD Law Society in Dublin gave you an honorary life membership. Is that, that's true?
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of those weird things that seems to happen when you're on a very successful show. It's just all these very surreal things come through the world. I remember I was on set when I got told about that. They said they want to fly you to Dublin to give you an honorary degree, which is a thing I guess they do with people that they decide they want to. I guess there's like a committee somewhere, a student body that votes on who they want to bring over to do it. So they flew me to Dublin and I got to give a speech and meet all the students. And it was that was early in the Suits year. So it was just sort of a surreal train ride and it just didn't stop.
Because there's law in this new show, too. I mean, is there something to be read into that? Like, were you surrounded by lawyers or anything like that growing up?
My mom says I'm an incredible arguer. I should have been on a debate team. I was not surrounded by lawyers. I don't know what it is. I don't know. I think once I decide that I believe something or that I want something, I can be very tenacious about achieving that goal. That's been something that's been the case since I was a little boy, which is why my mom gets such a kick out of me playing lawyers on TV. But I think there is something to that, that I connect to material where, and this, you know, project on CBC Plan B is very much the same. I mean, as a character who knows exactly the way that he thinks the world needs to be structured and organized in order for everybody to be happy. And if everybody would just do exactly what he thinks needs to be done, then everything would be good. And while I don't think I live my life that way anymore, I can certainly connect to it. And I think I'm probably still working through some of that. And that's why these roles keep sort of showing up into my life.
I mean, that's an interesting way of thinking about this character. You know, for people who haven't seen the show, you work in a law firm, yeah, but it's like, it's also sort of a relationship drama with a little bit of time travel mixed in. But the way you identify this character you play as Plan B in the show, mm-hmm. Plan B. I just got a note that said, please mention Plan B.
Plan B.
Yeah, Plan B on CBC.
Plan B
it is. That you see him as someone who wants there to be order in the world. And if everything can be kind of done the way that he sees life, then the world would make a lot more sense. Whereas mm-hmm. I think I saw the character as maybe more of like a toxic dude, you know, sort of like not being great. Not like, talk to me about tapping into that part of him.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of like your job as an actor when you take on a role is, because I have the same response, gutturally, like, well, this is a really toxic situation. I mean, I can see very clear, my judgments can come out quite easily as a viewer and go, well, this is really problematic. And I can see all the places this person's making a mistake, so on and so forth. When, you know, you play a role, you have to kind of look at it through a different prism. You have to try and come at it from, well, why? Why is this person doing this?
State the reason for your trip.
The reason for my trip.
The system could not register your answer. Please try again. Please try again.
I want a second chance.
The system could not register your answer. Please try again.
To win back my girlfriend.
I'm sorry, I did not understand.
That's a f***ing reason!
Please try again.
He deeply believes that if he's just given the chance to just change a few small details, he'll be able to get this right. He'll be able to change his behavior, you know, and he's not really realizing that at the same time he's doing the most ultimately toxic thing possible, which is changing the direction of other human beings' lives, namely his partner, in this case, Ev, and leaving her out of that decision-making process.
We're invited to...
It's your mom's birthday.
You remembered?
Yeah, of course. And she's having a dinner. And I think we should go.
Are you messing with me? You never want to go to my parents.
Yeah, but I want to go now.
But, I mean, I think that's relatable. If you were given the chance, if you had messed up your life, if you had made decisions that had gotten yourself into a situation that was seemed irreparable and you were given the opportunity to go back and make it right again somehow, you know, who wouldn't maybe take that opportunity?
Does making the show then change, I guess, your relationship with regret?
Playing this character makes me want to be much more present and much more accountable in my own life. Be very careful about the decisions that I make, and then be very aware of when a mistake has been made and know how to create reparations in the moment. You know, I believe that we're constantly faced with the same struggle and the same challenge until we figure out a way to overcome it. And usually that's by changing some part of ourselves, evolving, growing, and realizing that, you know, the reason that that challenge keeps presenting itself to our lives is because we haven't quite figured out how to process it or deal it or move through it. So we all have that opportunity in our lives to change the way that we interact with a challenge.
Doing research for this interview and watching the show at the same time is interesting because there's a scene, I think pretty early on in Plan B, where mm-hmm. Your characters are lying in bed, mm-hmm. you and Corinne Vernas, and you're talking about wanting to be in the moment versus always feeling like you're somewhere else.
I think I try to be in the moment, to be grateful for each experience as it's happening.
That's my problem. I'm always trying to be somewhere other than where I am. It's like the life that I want is just always out of reach.
I'm particularly susceptible to this kind of factoid because it's a really big part of my life as well. I believe you have a meditation practice, right? Can you talk to me a little bit about that? About like, because that's a big part of my life. So using that to try and find balance and presence in your life.
I mean, it's been absolutely essential. I'm far from a perfect meditator, not that there's any such thing, but I have said in the last like 3 years, it's become a very serious part of my life. And I can tell when I've drifted away from it because of the exact thing that I think we're talking about, which I find myself consistently in moments where I'm not in the moment. I could go days, you know, I've been too busy. Things have been going on. The kids are sick. You know, there's a problem at school, like whatever. We always find our reasons, and I'll get to the end of a 2 or 3 or 4 day stretch and I haven't meditated. And I realize that's the problem, that I'm not being present for anything, the good stuff or the bad stuff. And it's a pretty simple and miraculous fix I've found in my life. And I don't know if you find it's the same thing, that I'm really capable of basically dealing with anything if I'm just present for it.
Yeah, and watching the show reminded me, and we're going to sound like we're doing this on a cushion right now, but it reminded me that there actually is no past. You know, there is no such thing as the past. There is no such thing as the future. There actually is only the present moment, and everything else is made
and it's
up.
Perfect. Yeah, exactly. Now we're really getting into it, and it's perfect the way that it is.
Yeah.
Exactly. Whatever is happening in this moment is perfect the way that it is. I mean, I am so far from being able to actually live that way or accept that in every moment of my life. But I do know that when I am faced with serious struggle or emotional distress or something has just gone wrong, you know, I have two choices. It's reject it, fight it, blame people, get angry, try and fix it, or just accept that that is the way that it's going. It's happening for a reason, whatever that means, but it is happening. And in that sense, it is kind of perfect the way that it is. And what I do next with that information is the most important thing I can do.
I'm Tom Power. You're listening to Q, and you're listening to my conversation with the Canadian actor Patrick J. Adams, who a lot of people know from his Screen Actors Guild nominated role in the show Suits. Patrick played a character named Mike Ross, who had this big romantic arc with this character named Rachel Zane, who was played by Meghan Markle. And they both left the show in 2018 after this big moment.
If I've learned one thing, it's that we never know what the future holds. And that can be a scary thing. But I know that there is nothing that I can't handle when I have you by my side.
You are the strongest man I've ever met, and you make me stronger. You're the husband I've always wanted. And I can't wait to begin our adventure together.
So, listen, I don't want to ask Patrick J. Adams questions about Meghan Markle. Like, that's not my job. But I wanted to know about what it's like when you're that close to something so big, like the Harry and Meghan marriage and backlash, and how that affected him. Here's the rest of our conversation. Patrick, I got a question for you, and I want to be cautious about how I ask it, because if I ask it the wrong way, it won't come across the way I want. I wanted to talk about Suits, and let me get to the end of the question.
Okay, sure.
So, I mean, I'm sure people now, when they hear Suits, they think about your former co-star Meghan Markle. You know, got married to Prince Harry, and it was a big thing. Mm-hmm. What I'm curious about is sort of something that happened to you through this, which is, you know, there was sort of my understanding of it is that there was some kind of accusation of bullying against Meghan Markle. And what you did, because she was your friend and your coworker, you spoke out in defense of her. Mm-hmm. I'm really curious about, I think there's a lot of like theoretical conversation around what social media and kind of bullying and all that stuff is doing to like us as a society. But it's rare that I get the chance to talk to someone who, even on a micro level like you did, found yourself at sort of like the center of it. Because, you know, you kind of got piled on. I believe you decided to delete some of your social media accounts.
I think I'm still on there, but I basically just avoid my mentions section. Yeah.
So I wonder if you could just talk to me a little bit about that, like maybe sure. Especially given everything you just talked to me about.
Yeah, of course. I'm going to move slowly because I choose my words carefully on this subject.
Yeah, of course,
no matter what you say, it could so easily be taken out of context. And the truth is that I'm really not at the center of anything. And that if I had one regret about sort of stepping into that fray, which I don't really have many, but it's that it makes it seem like I'm at the center of anything. And, and all I was doing when I spoke out about that publicly was just standing up for a friend, somebody who I worked with for years. I just felt like it was important for someone to stand up and just go like, this is insane.
I'm curious about what that does to you. Like when you're at sort of the receiving end of a lot of online kind of horribleness.
Look, I don't like it. As I said, I stopped checking into my mentions account. I just started blocking a lot of accounts. I didn't want to interact with it. It made me regret a little bit stepping into it because I just felt like, yeah, who am I to be walking into this? Megan is a powerful woman, and she is capable of dealing with a lot. And when I stepped into it, I was like, I don't think this is the place for me to be engaging. And I certainly didn't want to continue it because it's not a conversation on social media. It's just a, you know, no one's there to have an intelligent dialogue about anything. So,
but I know what it's like to like interview someone on my show who's like, you know, in the news a lot, and I can catch the sort of strays of that. Like, and I think to myself, like, if this is like 2% of what this person I've talked to has gone through, I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
It,
you know? I mean, I'm not built for it is what I learned from this process. Like that level of scrutiny, that level of everything you do and say, I mean, just in this right now, we're talking about Megan. I know that at any point, any clip from this conversation could be taken from someone else, taken out of conversation. I'm not worried about it.
The nice thing is no one listens to me, so it's okay. Don't worry about it.
But more importantly, like I'm aware of that. And that's like you said, 1% of what the Megans or the Harrys or any of these people that are in the limelight constantly do have to deal with. Like there's no move that goes unscrutinized or taken out of context. So I have learned through that process, I'm not built for that level of scrutiny. And it makes me want to make my world a little bit smaller rather than, you know, bigger.
Yeah.
Surround myself with the things that matter to me most. I've had two kids in the last year, and it's like, that's all I want to do. I would like just take care of what I can take care of. It's all so unmanageable out there, that size, the life at that size.
I mean, you know, and it was a pretty amazing run there, you know, a Screen Actors Guild nomination for Suits and Outer Critics Circle nomination for Take Me Out on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And you spent the first 19 years of your life living here in Canada before you moved to LA, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm from Toronto. I was born and raised in Toronto.
You don't have to tell me this if you don't want to, but do you feel pulled back here at all?
Yes, I love Toronto. It's a push and pull. You know, I don't feel the desire to call it home again, especially after I sort of returned for a second time for Suits. Like I left Toronto when I was 19 and thought, oh great, that part of my life is over. Like I was ready to move on to whatever was next. And when I packed my bags, it really felt permanent. So to be brought back to the city for this major job at first was a little like, oh, this is not like I wanted to be out in the world, not back where I was an awkward and insecure kid. Like this isn't where I'm supposed to be, but it ended up being miraculous. I got to relearn the city as an adult. I got to make it a new home for myself. I got to be close to my family. But that being said, then when I left again at the end of Suits, I felt okay. Now I'm done with Toronto. Not like I can't come back, but I don't want to live here anymore.
There's a certain joy in seeing you in Plan B in Montreal. There's a certain joy in seeing you in like that Canadian sort of context, you know.
I'll tell you, it was a big reason I wanted to do the job as well. I'd actually gone to my reps and said, like, I really want to be working in Canada more. I think there's something that happens when you leave Canada and you come down. And I was quite young when I left. I didn't have a career when I left, obviously. I was just coming out of high school. And so I built this whole sort of career for myself down here. And I think there's this expectation that you don't want to come back. You know, you've left and you're down there and you don't want to participate in what we're doing up here. And I And I sort of woke up one day, I was like, well, that's just not true. And maybe the powers that be in Canada don't know that that's not true. So we sort of just went on a mission to see if there was anything that I could come and work on in Canada. And literally days later, Plan B came along.
And it's an interesting, I'm grateful to your time. Like, it's an interesting sort of a couple of things coming together. You know, you were hoping to do a little bit more work here. You get to do it in Canada. You're thinking a little bit about like the way you want the world to be and what you force onto the world. And then this character is sort of based on that. You're meditating a lot. You're thinking a lot about mindfulness and the idea of being present and there being no future in the past. I mean, it's a beautiful little convergence of you and your life right now, this show turned out to be.
Yeah, it has been. It's been beautiful.
Well, it's lovely to meet you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Tom. I really appreciate it.
Patrick J. Adams stars in Plan B, which airs Mondays at 9:30 in Newfoundland and parts of Labrador on CBC Television. You can watch it for free on CBC Gem. All right, that is it for the show today. Tomorrow on the show, Adele Berthe, who may not be a household name, but that's kind of the point. She was the front woman of a band called The Bloods, the first ever all-woman, all-queer, out rock band. And Adele's going to be here to talk about how homophobia held her career back in the 80s and what it's like to watch so many queer musicians top the charts in 2023. Adele Berthe will be here. If you want to follow me on Instagram, I'm at Tom Joe Power. The show is at CBCQ. We'll see you soon. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.